Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. My next guest is Lindsay Lyons. She is an educational justice coach who works with teachers and school leaders to inspire educational innovation for racial and gender justice, design curricula grounded in student voice, and build capacity for shared leadership. Lindsay taught in New York City public schools, holds a PhD in leadership and change, and is the founder of the educational blog and podcast, Time for Teachership. Welcome to the podcast, Lindsay.
Thank you so much, Dana. It's good to be here.
Well, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Yeah, I think for me, it is kind of looking back at the early start to my teaching career. And so year one, to paint the picture, I was just out of college. I was actually doing a teacher prep program. So I was in New York City teaching fellows, which is similar to some of the other programs out there, the kind of accelerated version of teacher school. And so while getting my master's, while teaching full-time, I was kind of putting in 20-hour work weekends. Mm-hmm. So 10 hours each weekend day at the library if it was open, no time for my family, kind of scrambling to create curriculum for my students. I taught, I think, 6 different courses at that time. So it was a little bit all over the place and wasn't very effective. I had an incredibly low student attendance rate. I remember even in year 3, I had a morning class and we had 35 students scheduled into that class. I think 1 or 2 was the average that we had show up. And it was just like, ooh, something needs to change. Like we are not doing right by students and something needs to change. And so I was luckily able to crawl out of the trenches by really pivoting my planning process, pivoting kind of how I spent my planning time in terms of the periods during the day, how I approached grading, how I approached even curriculum design actually helped me with that as well. On the end of like what I was grading, part of that was, what do I even put in front of students to complete in the first place? And how do I really think differently about not just my planning time and grading time, but how I'm spending time in the class with students? Can I give formative feedback? Can I give students more choice so that they're actually showing up to class so that I do have something to grade and assess and give feedback on? And also a huge shift in that was, how do I center what's important to students and what's important to their daily lived realities? And so I started exploring the opportunity of teaching a course that culminated in a standardized test. Still had to do that. But instead of doing test prep, I was like, what if we just did some activism-based, justice-based curricula that students were already talking about this stuff? Maybe they can actually do this in the class. Maybe that would generate some excitement. And my attendance went way up. Academic achievement went way up. My ability to teach went way up. And I was a lot less stressed because I was making those gains and not putting in 20-hour work weekends. At some point, I got to the point where I wasn't even taking any work home, which was amazing.
Wow. And how long ago was that kind of, how long did you kind of have that burnout phase and then kind of work in this new type of justice-based curricula?
Yeah, I think it was about 2.5 years was the major burnout phase. Okay. And I was ready to actually quit teaching at the end of year 3. And so it was this pivot point of something needs to change or I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And so year 2.5, like midway through year 3 was when I started pivoting towards project-based learning and some of the more pedagogical shifts. The justice piece came in once I was solidly based in a different curriculum design approach that was really centered in projects. And then I realized I could do a lot more with justice. So that I would say was probably year 4.
Yeah. And that's, I think, something that a lot of teachers have kind of realized over the past year when they're designing a lot more of their curriculum lessons, when they've had to teach a lot online and just kind of making sure they're not spending all hours of the day, right? As you said, grading and planning and just there's an easier way to do it, right? You don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Exactly.
I think a lot of us can resonate in that story of yours. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how you started your blog and podcast. And like you said, it started as a blog, transitioned to into a podcast, and what kind of themes you have for that.
Absolutely. So it's interesting you asked about how I started it. It started as before LMSs, or maybe LMSs existed, but I didn't know about them. In my first couple of years of teaching, I actually started a Weebly website for my students and for families. And so that's actually how my blogging started. It eventually shifted into, I would do daily, weekly, and eventually semesterly kind of accounts of what I was doing in the classroom. And I just wanted to kind of get in touch with families, and students could connect if they missed a day. And eventually that extended to a lot of teachers who were starting to follow my blog, which was Gender Studies for All. And then I realized that I could expand that and be relevant for a lot of different content areas. And so that's when I got out of teaching full time, started to transition to coaching, and realized Time for Teachership was this really cool intersection of teaching and leading. And so the themes I think that I address a lot, and then my guests address a lot, are really teaching for justice. So at a curriculum and pedagogical level, there's that piece. And then leading for justice and thinking about student voice at the school governance level and shared leadership practices.
And do you have guests on your podcast that then are kind of in that space, teaching for equity and justice, or not only educators, but people just in the community?
Ooh, that's a good question. I have teachers, I have leaders, I have had a couple people. I just interviewed someone. This will go live, I think, in June, the episode I just recorded. So it might be out. But thinking about like poetry and activism, we had that conversation, and it's a person who is, you know, he's actually a police officer. He is a self-described activist. He's a published author of poetry, but not at all, has never been an educator. And so it was really cool to kind of get into that community space as well. So I'm excited that I'm starting to explore that, and you're giving me some ideas of who else I could contact.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause we can always find, some nuggets, right, in the community, and just people that maybe like that guest, somebody who's written something that people can benefit from, students can learn from. So yeah, that's the joy of having a podcast and getting to know these people, not only in the educational space.
Yes.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the PD that you provide and the types of school that you work with.
Sure. Yeah. I've worked with a lot of different schools. I think my niche is really high schools, but I've worked from K through college. As an adjunct professor myself, I think there's also a lot to do in the college space, but my K-12 band and really the 9-12 band is my preference. But I do workshops, I do online courses, and then I have more intensive coaching packages, because a lot of what I'm talking about in my PD and my one-off workshops are these kind of transformative practices, these mindset shifts that are really transformative when done well and implemented over time. But a lot of times what I've seen, even as a teacher, is we have these two-hour workshops or these one-day workshops, and then we shelve them. We have the binder that we got from them or something, and we don't return. And so that really helped me to think about what long-term things can I put together. So I've created self-paced online courses, which are kind of start to finish. One of them is called Work Less, Teach More. And that one is all about how I climbed out of the trenches of the planning process and bringing a lot less work home and having more work-life balance. Another one is Curriculum Bootcamp, which is all about how I learned to design for project-based learning, for mastery-based grading, and centering justice in curriculum. And then I also have some wraparound coaching packages. So I have a Curriculum Bootcamp that's actually a live coaching version, which is kind of this two-day intensive where we get together as a department or a grade team, and we just create units. And so by the end of the 2 days, you have a full unit, start to finish, you know, the lessons, the all of it, the project, the rubric. And then for leaders, I have, you know, workshops, and not an online course yet, but a coaching package that's a semester long, really thinking about how do I set up the structures of shared leadership. So we're not doing a one-off equity policy revision period where we're never returning to policy discussion for the next 5 years until the next strategic plan, but we're actually setting up, you know, these structures for ongoing student and family and teacher voice that are intimately involved in policy and decision-making at the school governance level. And so setting that up is really a coaching intensive for that semester and getting that foundational pieces set up.
Yeah, and that's something I can imagine a lot of schools have a need for right now is just somebody to help walk them through that process, especially if they don't have much in their unified improvement plan in terms of equity or, you know, shifting to equitable practices. And, you know, a lot of districts that are around where I live in Colorado, you know, they're thinking about how do we bring that more to the building level, right? It's been adopted as a strategic goal of the district, but like, you know, every building needs to look at how that, what that looks like for them. So yeah, I think that's a good type of package that you know, a lot of leaders can benefit from. Let's talk a little bit about some of the ways that in your mind and experience that schools can partner with students and families, also kind of in terms of this equity piece and just in terms of, you know, working on that unified improvement plan and goals.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about actually a conversation that I just had for my own podcast, where I interviewed a superintendent who is developing their strategic plan right now. Mm-hmm. And she put out a call for students, teachers, family members, and community members to be a part of the planning process. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Super cool. Superintendent Fernandez in a district in Massachusetts. She's doing really cool things. And I think that's one way it can look like starting at the strategic plan level. You have that kind of every 5 years it has to be done. So using that as an opportunity to really dig in and say, we're going to create these structures for the strategic planning process. And then perhaps they carry over and are kind of consistently meeting even after the strategic plan is finished. There are moments to kind of come back and use that document as a reference point to check out, you know, are we still doing that thing? Do we need to pivot because things have changed or we've gotten new information or new data? And then also I think another lens that I come through is my dissertation research. And so my student voice area of study is really where I started, but I expanded very quickly to shared leadership more broadly. And I found that in the student voice field, particularly, and when we map that to kind of school governance, I found that five mechanisms really stick out in terms of what it is that works when we have students at the table in school governance, and including family, of course, and teachers as well as students. One is this embracing of radical collegiality, which is what Michael Fielding defines as kind of this partnership, this seeing students and family members as a partner versus a kind of one-way communication point of the spectrum where we're telling families what's happening in schools and then expecting that there's just kind of this acknowledgement that yes, school knows best, right? We're actually partnering. We're learning from one another. We're sharing responsibility for student success. And so that's kind of a mindset shift that I think is really critically important. There's a representative leadership team. It would be point two. And so that's a mechanism that we can set up where we have a leadership team that's usually about 15 members, a little bit more than that, and it gets a little unwieldy. But here's the really interesting thing, I think, that student voice researchers have found, that we have a slightly higher percentage of students than adults on the team, then we actually have student voice in a way that works, because otherwise students are super intimidated by being like the token student on an all adult panel, right? And they can't actually find a space for voice. I think the third thing would be to be just really clear.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
Here's what we're going to share in terms of the governance. We're going to make this decision around this topic together. Mm-hmm. And here's what is just the principal's job. So I'm going to decide a couple things on my own as a principal. And then some things will be just maybe my small leadership team. And then other things, big policy decisions, big changes in practice. We're going to go through a whole feedback loop. We're going to survey all the stakeholders. We're going to come back to the table together. We're going to go back again to see if the edits make sense to everybody. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, lack of clarity is really a struggle for some people. And that's where we can say we're a teacher-run school. We can say we're all about student voice or family partnership. But that kind of crumbles when we aren't clear about what that looks like.
Yeah.
And then the fourth thing, I think I said five, I meant four. And the fourth thing is really stakeholder research. And I think you spoke a little bit about, we've spoken a bit about data. And so I think that data is really important. What data we're looking at is really important. Mm-hmm. And if we can have an expansive view of data versus just you know, the grades or the test scores. I think we do a lot better when we can include some self-report data and we can include surveys. Do families feel like they belong to the community? Are they valued when they walk into the building? Mm-hmm. Do students feel that way? And so I think there's a lot there too.
Yeah, that kind of ties into that question I was talking to you about in the pre-chat about how the data schools collect impact equity. And having been an administrator in a Title I school, I kind of see how that, you know, impacts like how we're serving those students who are free and reduced lunch, or if we have a large number of Latinx students, for example. But I think, you know, like you're saying, that partnership with the families is a critical piece of that. But how do we kind of explain to the families how we're using the data in layman's terms?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think when we reach out to families, a lot of times we kind of choose one way to reach out. Yeah. And then, you know, a family member doesn't have a cell phone or they don't have an email address or, you know, and we say, okay, there's not that back and forth communication. They're not responding. So I think first, just being able to be thoughtful about what are the best ways that we reach out and what are the various ways we welcome families in. So if it's family school night, you know, what about the people who work nights? You know, if it's family school day, what about the people who work days? And just making sure that there is an actual opportunity for families to be able to have that back and forth conversation. And then I think also another piece that's often missing is kind of the follow-up. I think families can tell if we're just asking questions on a survey, but we never follow up on what the families report that they need, or that they don't feel like they belong, or they're not being listened to. You know, if we're not taking action as a result of the survey, and students too, for that matter, if we're not taking action based on those results, there's going to be kind of this disengagement of, we're not actually going to fill out the survey. Why would I waste 10 minutes doing this if you're not acting on it? Right. But also this lack of trust. So if I am filling it out, if I am answering, I'm not answering honestly because I don't feel like anything will actually be done. And so I think those things are really important to kind of keep in mind as well.
Yeah, and that kind of reminds me of a job when I was collecting attendance data, and then I would interview the families aside from the students, kind of, and then develop a plan based on the answers to the two surveys, right? And so, you know, that was really interesting collecting that data and seeing kind of that trajectory. Obviously, we have the data on the student going back to their grades in the past, but also kind of looking at those intrinsic and extrinsic motivators for coming to school, right? And then, but yeah, I wouldn't say that was a survey that was kind of one and done, because you did then communicate further with the family if the attendance didn't improve. And I hope that that helped the family feel like they were more partnering with us, right? Because I often feel like families are called, right, when something negative is happening, grades, attendance, or discipline, and they think the school's out to get them or judge them as a parent. And that's why both of us have that commonality, and like, it's so important to bring them on board and partner with them, right? So
absolutely. Yeah. And I think to your point too about how do you communicate it in layman's terms as well, I think sometimes we create as scholars, as researchers, we create sometimes these surveys or these items that just are really heavy in researcher language as well. And so I think being able to create a survey, I've learned so much about survey creation just through my dissertation, and I had a wonderful mentor in doing that, but she was really insistent that it should flow like a conversation. We should use language that's really accessible. And we should also explain exactly why we're doing each piece of the survey. Like, why are we asking these questions and how is it relevant? And I think so much of that from surveys that I've taken as an individual is lacking. And then I'm not as invested in providing the information. I'm not as confident that it's going where I need it to go, or I'm just confused and frustrated because I don't understand what they're actually asking me to say.
Yeah, I get that kind of, and just making sure that the parents are able to kind of understand why the survey is being done as well, and how we're going to use the results of the survey. I wanted to shift a little bit and talk about unconscious biases, both being white females, and just kind of what are some of those biases when we're working with students or families that often, you know, are coming up that we're not necessarily aware of, and how can we be more open to, I would say, just doing better and overcoming some of these biases that maybe we've grown up with.
Absolutely. I think the work is never done. And so I think the first and foremost thing I do is just say that I'm taking a learning orientation everywhere I go. So even as a facilitator of professional development, one of the things I try to do at the start is just to be very clear that, you know, I am not striving for perfection. I think perfection is a tool of white supremacy, which is some interesting thing that I've been grappling with as a recovering perfectionist, and thinking about a tendency for more progress and an ability to respond with grace and gratitude when I do make a mistake. I think that's just a really important frame for me, not just to have as a person, but also to share with others, to model for white folks who might be in the workshops that I am facilitating. And just to say, you know, I don't think we can ever create spaces that are safe for everyone, because safety is this personal thing, right? Each person's going to feel different and safe and vulnerable at different times, but creating a space that at least lets people know that I recognize the need as a facilitator and as a white person to accept some feedback that might be critical and hard to take, but that I am actively working on, you know, the response being the most important piece, how I respond with gratitude and grace versus that I'm entrenched in being right or wrong. And so I think that's a really important thing to just kind of frame the conversations. I also think, you know, it's a lifelong learning process that also requires me to do my own work. And so I think sometimes as white people, you know, it's a tendency to kind of put work on others, put work on people who are, you know, BIPOC folks or others who are not me, right? And just be like, oh, this is something else someone can teach me. I think about this very powerful example from the Teaching Hard History podcast. Hassan Kwame Jeffries talks about how his son, I don't remember how old his son was, but in elementary school, and his child was in a class about Rosa Parks was being discussed. And the teacher shared what most people learn about Rosa Parks, which is this very abbreviated version of her in history. And came home and said, you know, we learned about Rosa Parks. And he says, okay, there's a lot more to that story. So we're going to unpack that. The kid let the teacher know. And the teacher said, you know what, you can teach the class, which is a really interesting example, because I think on one hand, we have this opportunity for student voice and for family voice and this opportunity for sharing expertise. But on the other hand, the white teacher asking a Black child to take responsibility for educating her versus doing her own homework, I think is really enlightening to me as I was listening to that. So I take that to mean, you know, I need to do my own research. I need to read a lot of nonfiction books. I need to watch a lot of documentaries. I need to basically teach the things that I wasn't taught. And many of us were not taught in schools. And especially as a teacher that I used to teach history and literacy, and these things are often rooted in white supremacy. So I actually have to unlearn and teach myself, you know, what was wrong and how I was taught to be able to do that work continuously. And again, the journey's never over. We're not going to be perfect, but if I can strive for progress, I think that'll be good.
Yeah. And that's a perfect example is we just had that 100-year marking the memorial of the Tulsa race massacre, right? And how, you know, I lived in Tulsa when I was in high school and they never talked about that, right? And so just kind of that unpacking the history that was hidden, right? And now recognizing those businesses and, you know, the families, the survivors, and finding out more about the history, you know, just that has been hidden by white supremacy. I think, like you're saying, you have a great point in watching documentaries, reading books, and just finding out more, right? Unlearning kind of how we learned to teach social studies. Do you have any like books that you would suggest listeners read?
Oh, so many books. Okay. Let's see. The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, I just think is fabulous. It's older now, but just, it was powerful. Cast by Elizabeth Wilkerson is also amazing. From an educational standpoint, I love Cultivating Genius. So less about unlearning history, but more just about how do we center justice and pedagogy and curriculum. And that's by Dr. Goldie Muhammad. Another educational book I loved in terms of centering justice and kind of thinking about pedagogy in new ways is by Dr. Bettina Love. We Want to Do More Than Survive. Oh, that's a really good one as well. There's a lot in the series of I can't remember like what the series, or I don't know if it would actually be named a series, but like in Indigenous history, or some, I'm trying to think of, there's like the Howard Zinn book of like a people's history of, and so there's like an Indigenous history of, you know, a people's history of for queer folks, you know, all of those that are kind of the history of, and then having different lenses, those books have been really helpful for me and just kind of relearning history.
Okay.
I think there's so many different things, but I think those were really powerful, for people, documentary listeners, I think, or documentary viewers, I should say. 13th is really powerful. So that's on Netflix. And I always have my students in my college class now watch that documentary. And then for podcasts, like I said, Teaching Hard History by Hassan Kwame Jeffries is really powerful. Mm-hmm. And Queer America comes out of Learning for Justice, their podcast series as well. And so that one's a really good one also.
Okay. Thank you so much for those suggestions. I'll put those in the show notes. Well, out of everything we talked about today on the podcast, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
I think the idea of going ahead and trying something out. Mm-hmm. So this idea of kind of perfectionism being something that inhibits action, mm-hmm. Sometimes is really powerful. I would say the most common thing that I hear when I start a workshop is people saying, particularly white folks saying, I don't want to say the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And so I might not speak. And so that like almost kind of shutting down to learning that opportunity that I totally resonate with as well. Like I've mm-hmm. been there. There are moments where I continue to be there at times, but I think if we can get past that to where we're not shutting down the learning, we're still engaging, mm-hmm. I think is really huge. And so the biggest thing I usually say at the end of all of my weekly emails and all of that is to think big. So mm-hmm. we have to have that expansive, what Bettina Love refers to as freedom dreaming. We have to act brave. So we have to get that courage up. We have to get that bravery going, because if it's not a brave action, you know, I question whether it's going to actually change much, right? We need to kind mm-hmm. of push against that status quo if it's unjust, and then to be your best self. Mm-hmm. And so that idea of being in connection with ourselves and our true set of values is really incredibly important, and also speaks to the act of self-care and service of justice that I think is really important for us as educators specifically. So think big, act brave, and be your best self.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those are great words to live by. And, you know, don't be afraid to take risks, I think would be something.
Yes, absolutely. If I hadn't taken risks, I think about the trenches question. And if I hadn't, you know, taken a risk to just totally change up how I was designing curriculum, how I was planning my school days, I never would have crawled out of those trenches.
Mm-hmm. Well, where can people find you online and connect with you?
Yeah, so I'm at most places at Lindsay Beth Lyons. Mm-hmm. And I think Twitter, because they shortened the requirement for the letters, I think is Lindsay B. Lyons. And okay. You can always email me at hello@lindsaybethlyons.com or go to my website, lindsaybethlyons.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast today. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, Dana. It was a pleasure to be here.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it. And if this episode resonates, especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.